players. Obviously, you weren't going to represent the managers, but was that a subject as to whether you would represent managers? And
they were in the pension plan.
I know it.
And therefore, yeah.
Yes and no, right?
If you're renegotiating the benefit plan, then they're covered. And so what we did, when we asked players to sign membership and dues checkoff cards, we included all the managers, all the coaches, and all the trainers, explaining that we still don't have a basic agreement. This is just on a pension plan, and since they are members, we will be negotiating their terms and conditions in the benefit plan.
And tell the people here again, what would a person retiring, let's say you played from 47 to 66 or 67, so you had 10 or 11 years in the majors, and then you were to retire. Obviously, you wouldn't get the benefit to a certain age, but let's say it's age 60, or I don't know how it worked in those days. What would a pension have paid a player with 10 years service?
10 years service? Before we negotiated our first plan, something like $100 a month.
$1,200 a year, roughly.
Yeah. Right.
Peanuts.
For contrast, today's pension goes up to $160,000 a year.
Which is the maximum under the ERISA, right? It couldn't go any higher.
Right.
And so a guy who had played 10 or 12 years really had nothing. I mean, it was less than Social Security, perhaps, or about Social Security.
That's true. No one was more startled than I, Faye, when I got into reading the details of the plan, because everywhere I went, people told me, hey, we got a great pension plan here. And later, I was trying to find an explanation for this, and it was the only thing they had.
And what would the maximum have been, the maximum you could get in 67?
Well, you had to be age 65 before you started it. You were eligible when you were age 50. But if you wanted the maximum, you had to be age 65. And in between, you got moderate increases for each year that you held off starting to draw the benefit. At age 65, it was roughly twice as much as I just said, about $200 a month.
No matter how much service, if you played 25 years.
Right, yeah.
Okay, so that puts it in perspective.
Yeah. Now, when we came time to negotiate the basic agreement covering all terms and conditions of employment outside of pensions and insurance, we ran into a roadblock. The owners committee said that these were management people. And of course, some of them were. The field managers, obviously management people. Question of whether coaches are management or not is a dicey question. Trainers probably would be considered management too. The owners took a position that we're not going to have a basic agreement covering the players unless we agree in writing that we don't represent the others. And I refused. I said, I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to insist in this first agreement that on all these other working conditions that the coaches and trainers and managers be covered. We'll have to resolve this maybe by going to the National Labor Relations Board and having them tell us which are employees and which are management. But I'm not going to sign it away without talking to the coaches and the managers and the trainers. And so it was decided on that basis. The agreement said we represent the players, did not say we don't represent the others.
But in the first agreement, what were you trying to achieve, and how much of it did you get? I mean, what was your essential first effort in 72? It wasn't 72, it was 67.
67, and it was really 68 by the time we got around to it. But well, first thing to do was to get recognition of the union as the sole collective bargaining representative. We already had a checkoff agreement, and now we were dealing first with the reserve clause. Believe it or not, in the first place.
Explain checkoff so people will know that meant that people's dues were going
to.
Okay.
Marvin, it might be worth pointing out the vote when you have officially won the election. Why don't you tell people what the official poll was?
Yeah, counting the negative vote totals in the West, the overall vote total in favor of my candidacy was 489 to 136, which is kind of a remarkable total in the sense that included among the voters were 120 management employees. And with a total negative vote of only 136, it looks like the players supported it after all.
Well, I would think the leadership that originally approached you probably had a lot to do with that. They no doubt did a lot of good work on your behalf.
Particularly Roberts and Bunning.
Yeah.
Yes, absolutely.
And we talked a little bit about the first negotiation. Can you just sort of put that in historical perspective?
Yeah.
How important was it to get established?
The pension and insurance agreement of December 1966 was important in the way that you've just indicated, in that we took a pension plan which was then 19 years old, and we more than doubled the benefits in one negotiation of those 19 years, and added awful lot of additional benefits, especially in the health insurance area. We followed that up with the first basic agreement, which, among other things, was the first increase in the minimum salary since 1962, I guess. Raised it from 6 to 10, with additional increases for future years. We took all of the spring training and in-season allowances and made up for lost time by increasing them largely. We added a cost of living provision so that each year it would go up automatically even when there were no negotiations. We raised the reserve clause issue and eventually settled on a two-year study labeled as a study to consider alternatives to the present reserve system. We tried negotiating a reduction in the number of games. They had increased the season total from 154 to 162 some years before that. And what I got from the players was that it was just enough of an increase to make the schedule far more onerous than it had been before. We were not successful in that, but we set up a study committee on that as well. We changed some option rules. We did a whole overhaul. For example, This is just an example of what happens when an employer really dominates the scene. In Major League Baseball, as you know from your own experience, the number of rules books can fill a library. You have the major league rules, and you have the major minor league agreement, and you have the contract of the commissioner, which is an agreement with rules of its own. You have the American League Constitution and bylaws, and the National League Constitution and bylaws, and on like this. The old uniform players contract, which every player was required to sign, this is before the union, said that all of these rules and books, and they specified them, were governed the player, and he was acknowledging that that was so by signing the contract. Well, in practice, not only was he agreeing to that, but when they would change it in, say, mid-season, they would say that since he had agreed to be bound by the major league rules or the major minor rules, whatever, he was bound by the changes too, even though his signature had occurred before the changes. Worse than all of that, when I inquired, I found out that nobody had ever furnished the players with copies of these things, which they were asking him to sign that he was comply with. It was that bad. We changed all that.
So at the end of that negotiation, how did you feel? You felt you made a contribution? Were you liking the job? What was your sort of personal view of how things were going?
As truthfully as I can, I felt that they were going well from the point of view of the player. Players were exceedingly complimentary and exceedingly satisfied. It was more than they had let themselves believe was going to happen. Mm-hmm. But my own feeling was that they had not set their standards high enough. And in part, I blamed myself, that perhaps I had been too conservative in indicating what was possible. So I had both feelings that, it was going well because the players were happy with what had been done. But inside me, I was unhappy in that I didn't consider it a lot of progress yet.
Because we're so limited in time, let's move to Curt Flood. Set the stage. I mean, Curt Flood, as you had said earlier, is a player for the Cardinals, gets traded, and eventually brings himself to challenge on antitrust grounds. The case gets to the Supreme Court. But tell us why it's historically important, why it was lost, and what you view it as, how important it is.
Yeah. First, on Curt Flood himself, it's important to recognize that by the time we got to 1969, Willie Mays was in his last few years as an active player. And it's pretty clear that Curt Flood at that point in his history was the reigning center field, greatest center fielder in the game. That's just to set the stage for this. When he was notified by a newspaper man that he had been traded, which was kind of typical in those days, he telephoned me and told me what had happened and said that he had discussed this with his personal attorney in St. Louis, and he wanted to file a lawsuit, an antitrust lawsuit, and could he discuss it with me? I said, okay, sure. And made an appointment, and he came in with his St. Louis attorney, and Richard Moss, who was first general counsel of the Players Association, and I met with the two of them. And we met all day long. And the best way I can summarize it is to say that Flood had made up his mind that he was going to file this suit. He was not going to report to the Philadelphia Phillies, and there was no arguing with that. He was going to do it. And really, all he wanted from me was an indication that the union would back him. From my point of view, the most important thing was to make sure that Kurt Flood knew what a million to one shot this was of winning this case.
Because if he lost it, he'd never play again. Is that correct? And though he had to understand that this was suicidal.
Absolutely.
From his point of view.
Absolutely. More than that, you know, because I wasn't shaking his resolve at all. I was playing devil's advocate, frankly, all the way. I wanted to make sure he had all the negatives. I said, I don't know, you know, what your plans are when you're no longer a player, whether you have managerial ambition and so on. I said, but if you do and you file this lawsuit, forget him. It's not going to happen. You're not going to be a manager. You're not going to be a coach. You're not going to be a scout. You know, this went on and on, I guess. I said, you know, I don't want to get into your personal life, and I don't want you to tell me anything, but I just want you to think about it. If there's anything in your personal life that you don't want to see on the front page of the newspaper, be cautious here, because you're going to see it.
Was some lawyer telling him that he had a reasonable chance to win this case? That is, was he getting professional advice that this was a possible victory?
No. But in part, I suppose you can blame me, because while I never held out that kind of thing, I often reviewed with the players in those spring training and sometimes September meetings, I often reviewed with them the what I thought of a Supreme Court's decision in the federal baseball case way back.
Justice Holmes, 1921,
right,
who held that baseball was not a business within the meaning of the antitrust laws.
Right, right. And, you know, it's even worse that when you read the opinion over again, you just shake.
And nobody can defend it.
And an industry that was then operating in seven states plus the District of Columbia was not an interstate industry.
Can't be defended. He was a great justice, but it can't be defended.
Right. And then the Tolson case, which, you know, came in 1953, where the court basically said, this is foolish, but we can't reverse the precedent here, stare decisis. We got to support what the court did so many years before. And I said that when a third case comes up, Kurt, the odds are absolutely a million to one against us. I said, it's even worse than I've painted it for you. I said, let me explain. I said, suppose we win the million to one shot. Court reverses the two prior decisions of the court. I said, you personally will not gain. He said, well, what do you mean? I said, well, think about it. Ordinarily, what you'd want is damages for what the reserve clause did to you. But this court, no court, is going to award damages for something that the court itself had said was perfectly legal, twice. So if you win the million to one shot, it will only be prospective for the future. You can't get a dime. And here is where you sometimes get the mark of a man. You know. He thought about it and he said to me, but if we win, it would benefit all the players in the future and all the players to come.
But wouldn't he have been a free agent?
I'm sorry?
Wouldn't he have been a free agent?
If I won? Maybe.
So my point is, if he'd been a free agent, he might have been able to make some money for the rest of his career. But you're right in terms of damages.
Right. Well, if he had said to me, you know, but I'll be a free agent, my answer then, Faye, would have been, who's going to sign you?
Yeah, that's a fair answer. We now know.
Yeah.
Especially in those days.
Right. But at any rate, when I said what I did, he said, but it would benefit all the other players. And I said, yes. And he said, that's good enough for me. And we've got full steam ahead.
Because it's interesting, as I told you earlier, I work for the justice who argued the case for him in the Supreme Court, and Goldberg really believed he had a good case. He was very disappointed he didn't win it.
Well, I never believed we'd win. I didn't go around dampening everybody's enthusiasm, but I never believed it.
Why don't you tell them what happened to Curt Flood after that? It's a sad story.
Yes. Well, while the case was pending, we didn't know how long it was going to take to wend its way from through all the federal courts to the Supreme Court. He went off to Europe, I think to Scandinavian nations first. His marriage had gone sour.
Was he an artist of some sort?
Yes, he was a portrait artist in St. Louis, had his own office and studios. And was reasonably successful at it, but he decided after testifying in the case in the lower courts and being told that he would not have to testify during the circuit court appeal or the Supreme Court appeal, went off to Europe.
And he never played baseball again, did he?
Well, he did. He.
Oh, yeah, that's right. But, at the end of his career.
The Phillies sold his contract to what were then the Washington Senators.
Yeah.
And Bob Short, who was one of the owners of the team, wanted to sign Flood. There was a problem because we were concerned that if he played, that a court could throw the case out as being... Cases moved at that point. We discussed it with Goldberg, and Goldberg met with Bowie Kuhn on that point, and they agreed that they would not argue that the case was moot. They wanted Flood to play. This by no means ensured that a court wouldn't say it was moot, because the court has a right to make its own decision.
Yeah.
But at least they weren't going to argue it. And so Curt came back, and a contract was negotiated with Bob Short.
I remember that.
Club had moved to Texas by this time. And Flood played just a few weeks.
Mm.
This was another thing I had warned him about. I said, you know, you're still a young man. He was 31 in the case that was filed. But I don't know of any case of anybody at the major league level who we didn't know how long the case would take. Sometimes a federal case can take 3 years, you know.
Mm.
And I took a worst case scenario and I said, you know, nobody's ever done this at your age to be a non-player for 2 or 3 years and then come back. It's, even if they don't blackball you, at any rate, he did come back and it was only 1 year that he was out. But he had very high standards for himself as a player. And he may have come around, but his skills had been dulled by the inactive. And he was hitting under 200 that April. And he just quit.
I'm worried about time. Let's go to Messerschmitt. I think probably if history books would say this was the critical a moment in recent baseball history.
Yes.
Could you set the stage for people 50 years from now and then take us through it reasonably briefly, because I'm worried about our...
Yeah, okay. Just one thing on Flood, because a lot of people, and maybe 50 years from now it'll be worse, but a lot of people think that we won that case in the course. We didn't win that case.
I know that.
As predicted, we lost 5-3 vote, so on.
And what the court basically said was, if Congress wants to fix this, let Congress fix it. We are not going to fix it.
Right.
It was a total cop-out, really.
Even though it was the court that created the imaginary exemption, not the Congress.
But what they said was, Congress has had all these years since 1921,
right,
and it has done nothing.
Right.
It's a legislative issue, not a judicial issue. Right. It was the ultimate sort of judicial cop-out.
Yeah, and more than that, Faye, in a sense, it was a congressional cop-out as well.
Well, sure.
And one president after another, Republican, Democrat, didn't matter. We know that the Attorney General of the United States has a right to enforce the antitrust laws. Doesn't need Congress. There's nothing in the Sherman Antitrust Act that exempts baseball. There's nothing in the Clayton Antitrust Act that exempts baseball. And so the chief law enforcement officer of the United States always was in a position to break up the baseball monopoly.
He would have had to take on the definition of baseball is not a business within the meaning of the antitrust law. That was why these guys had a basis for copping out.
Well, but even after that, you see, in 72, the owners said in court, this is an industry in interstate commerce, we are not arguing that. Now show me the action after 72.
No, there's nothing.
Nothing.
No, I agree with that.
Right. At any rate, Andy Messersmith, as was a star pitcher, first for the California Angels, and then for the Los Angeles Dodgers, 20-game winner in one league, 19-game winner in the other league, leading earned run average, a fine pitcher. In the year 1975, trying to negotiate a contract with the Dodgers for that year, failed, and the Dodgers used the reserve clause renewal and signed his renewed his contract for the 75 season without his signature. They were in disagreement on two things. One on salary, and that was not the major disagreement. Andy Messersmith was kind of shocked when the California Angels traded him to the Dodgers. He loves California to this day. And what he wanted was to be assured he wasn't going to be traded again somewhere. And so he asked the Dodgers for a no-trade provision. If the irony of this, you know, here's a player who eventually becomes